Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Christina Namath, Director of the Club's Travel Program. To learn about programs, membership, and traveling with the Club, visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. It is my pleasure to introduce the moderator for today's program with Kenya Serrano, member of Cuba's Parliament. Walter Turner is professor of social sciences and contemporary African affairs at the College of Marin and president of the board of directors at Global Exchange, a San Francisco-based human rights organization. He is also the host and producer of the weekly radio program Africa Today on KPFA Radio, a unique program focused on contemporary Africa and the African diaspora. Mr. Turner has traveled extensively throughout southern and western Africa and worked as a journalist in South Africa, Kenya, Cuba, Nigeria, and Venezuela. His commentaries have appeared in The Black Scholar and on Pacifica National News, National Public Radio, and PBS. Please join me in welcoming Professor Walter Turner.
Thank you. I can't think of a better venue to have a program than the Commonwealth Club. I've looked at the Commonwealth Club from afar for many years and had an opportunity to attend some of the program, but it is certainly a perfect venue for the conversation that we're having today. It's my pleasure to introduce Kenya Serrano. She is a leading member of the Cuban Parliament as well as the president of ECAP, the Cuban Institute for Friendship with the People. The mission of ECAP since its founding in 1960 has been to reach out to establish friendship and mutual solidarity with countries around the world. Ms. Serrano has represented Cuba throughout the world for more than 20 years in international forums in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean. She was a Cuban representative to the widely respected Interparliamentary Union, which focused on democracy, women, and human rights, and along with former President Fidel Castro, she attended the World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa. Ms. Serrano was promoted to the Department of International Relations of the Central Committee of the Cuban Communist Party and coordinated the area of North Africa until March 2009, when she was appointed the first female president of ECAP. Please join me in welcoming Kenya Serrano.
Thank you.
I was reflecting on a comment I saw Kenya make in one of her earlier presentations when she was talking about leaving and coming to the United States on this most recent visit. And she was saying that our countries are so close and yet so far that you don't even have a chance to have a cup of coffee. And yet over these last 60 years, the relationships have been tense and at times confused. I wanted Kenya to say a few words first to give us a little bit more about why ECAP, the role of ECAP, and then I wanted her to talk very specifically around the pronouncements which were made at the end of 2014 by President Barack Obama and President Raul Castro on the process of normalization. And Kenya was clear to me, she said, we call it the process towards normalization. Kenya.
Thank you so much. Good morning, everyone. I thank you for coming, and I thank the Commonwealth Club and also Global Exchange, because we have had a very good experience having groups coming to Cuba, thanks to the work that Global Exchange does in terms of visiting our country. I will do my best speaking in English. If not, you correct me. We are very open-minded in all aspects. So first of all, ECAP is a social institution. It was created at the very beginning of the Cuban Revolution. You remember the revolution triumphed on January 1st, 1959, and it was in December the 30th, 1960, where our Prime Minister, then Prime Minister Fidel Castro, signed the law that created our institute. And it is a window of Cuba to have understanding relations with the world, and also for receiving people coming from many countries of the world coming to Cuba to see our reality. Currently, we have relations with a network of more than 2,000 associations, NGOs, and groups in 153 countries of the world. It means that we receive in Cuba people coming from different countries. Last year, for instance, we received more than 8,000 people coming from 82 countries of the world. They come from many countries, of course, from the United States. Because of the new situation, we are receiving more and more visitors, about 3,000 a year. In our experience, ICAP, with our travel agency, Amistur. And also we receive people from many other countries, as I have said before. We receive people in delegations. We receive people coming to Cuba to do voluntary work in Cuba with us, with the grassroots and community groups that we have in our country. And we also receive people that wants to do specialized programs. It is to see how does the Cuban healthcare system functions, how do the many areas in our social and economic development is functioning in Cuba today. And also, you know that since the beginning of the revolution, Cuban has been suffering the impact of the US blockade. And then many of those people are interested in coming to Cuba to see how the blockade is impacting our reality, how the blockade is limiting our right to development as a country, but also, in the other hand, I feel that many of them want to see how resilient we are. How have we been able to build a different society in Cuba with many achievements? And I feel that it is a very important experience for many of them. ICAP is also having very special relations with students coming from abroad to study for free in Cuba. Currently, we have students from 118 countries of the world in Cuban universities. 80% of them are receiving free scholarships. And then there is other amount whose governments pay for them to go to Cuba and study. So it's a combination. And we are very proud to receive more than 100 students from the US coming from the underserved communities of the United States to study medicine for free in Cuba in the Latin American School of Medicine. And also another very important experience that we have is to send delegations to countries where solidarity is needed. We have been sending people to more than 40 countries of the world every year. We are able to finance ourselves. That's why we are autonomous as an institute. And of course, I believe that ICAP have had very good experiences showing that, for example, good relations, respectful relations, civilized relations between Cuba and the US, between Cuba and the many countries of the world, it is possible if we are ready to respect each other.
This process of normalization that began with the announcements in December by both presidents, give us a sketch from your role with ECAP and as a member of the National Assembly. How has this process evolved? What are some of the challenges? What are some of the progress that's been made?
Yes, thank you. Well, first of all, it is the first time in history that we can see that our two presidents are talking by phone, are addressing the public directly. It happened last December the 17th, and they announced the decision to start doing the necessary steps in order to achieve the rejoining of the US-Cuba diplomatic relations. You know that the relations were broken back in 1962. So it means that for more than 50 years, we didn't have diplomatic relations, and it was a very important achievement, Walter. I believe that diplomatic relations are the normal channel for all countries to be in good communication and to protect the nationals, the Cuban nationals, and the people coming from the US. And it is normal. There are many UN conventions, the Geneva Conventions, and many others that establish that it is the best way, the best channel to have good communications. Another thing is that the US administration has recognized the failure of the U.S. policy on Cuba. It is very important because many people here, including the Secretary of State, John Kerry, he has said that it was the U.S. the one that was left isolated with that policy. So it is the recognition that the policy didn't function, that Cuba was not isolated. Currently, we have relations with more than 192 countries of the world. It is almost all the members of the United Nations General Assembly. Another thing is that our two presidents say that they were open to receive proposals in order to advance in many areas of cooperation. And then on July the 20th, the Cuban embassy was open in Washington. In August the 14th, the U.S. embassy was open in Havana. Now we have embassies in the two countries. Now more people from Cuba is coming with visas, with regular travels to the United States, not only in private travels, but also in our case that we come here in order to talk to you, to the people in the United States. So it is a new moment as a result of those decisions. Another thing has to do with a combination of complexities. Because, yes, we have diplomatic relations, but the blockade is still there. So the blockade should be lifted by the U.S. Congress. Although Obama, as a president, he has various prerogatives in order to make the impact of the U.S. blockade easier for the Cuban people and for the people of the United States, and also for the people in third countries, because the blockade currently is not only affecting Cubans and U.S. citizens, but also people living in third countries that the blockade, for instance, the Helms-Burton Law that was approved back in 1996, established the extraterritorial character of the U.S. blockade. So if there is a company willing to have trade with Cuba, if they have trade with the U.S., if they have some business here in the U.S., they are not allowed to have business with Cuba, things like that. Cuba is not allowed to buy products in other countries with a component of more than 10%. Now Obama is saying, okay, you could buy products with 25% of U.S. raw materials. It is the way it is functioning now. But in the case of a medicine, for instance, do you imagine a patient with Alzheimer's in Cuba expecting a medicine from Pfizer laboratory? We cannot buy 25% of the medicine. We need the medicine. So it is one of the examples how complex it is right now. But of course, we recognize the positive decisions that have been made by Obama, by the current administration. And we consider that another aspect, it is a challenging aspect, is the illegally occupied territory in Guantanamo for more than a century now. There is a prison there, but that territory is our territory and it is illegally occupied for more than a century now. So we are demanding the U.S. government to return it to our sovereignty. Another very important thing we would like to tell you is that many regime change programs have been going to Cuba through different means. They are investing federal money through the U.S. aid, through the National Endowment for Democracy, and some other ways in order to what they call the democracy empowerment of the Cuban civil society and the independent sectors of Cuba. So it is a contradiction to say that we are in favor of the better relations and on the other hand to try to achieve the same goals but with different means. So we believe again that those programs should stop and we have to think in a very good cooperation between our two countries. Let us see in the case of Ebola situation in Africa. We were able to cooperate with the US and it was a very good cooperation. Let us see the situation in Haiti today. We were able to cooperate, and it is a very good example. Why not? Let us talk about drug trafficking. We can cooperate in this aspect also. So there are many areas where we could cooperate, but of course those things are main obstacles for the process towards the normalizing of the relations between Cuba and the United States. The blockade, Guantanamo occupation, the regime change programs that are establishing a real noise in the channel today.
In a recent presentation before the United Nations vote, I believe it was October 27th, the Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez made the point, he said, quoting, "We should not mix up reality with wishful thinking or expressions of goodwill." Expound a bit on the word which I often hear, the word sovereignty, and its role in the relationship between Cuba and the United States.
Yes. We are very jealous about our independence and about our sovereignty. It has cost a lot to our people. More than 200 years of struggle, many Cubans have died in that process. And also because the only way that Cubans can continue going for ourselves, it is being independent and achieving and preserving, let's say, preserving our sovereignty. And now in Latin America and in the Caribbean countries, that process is very strong currently. Not only Cuba is saying that, we are having a very strong and common position in the Latin American and Caribbean countries where we decided not to be the backyard of the US anymore. It is a very important decision we made. And we have, for instance, CELAC, the Latin American and Caribbean community of states, and it is a very open and diverse space for coordination and cooperation. We have ALBA countries, that there is a group of countries, Venezuela, Cuba, Ecuador, Bolivia, and 11 countries in the Caribbean and in South America, mainly in the South, and also some Andean countries members. And we decided to have a complementary cooperation among us. So why not to respect that, Walter? It is necessary to respect that. And I believe that we have to see the day that the US is not only correcting the policy on Cuba, it's correcting the policy towards regarding the US relations with the Latin American and Caribbean countries, because we could have a very good results on that here in San Francisco. I feel sometimes that I am in Latin America because there are many Latino communities and Caribbean communities here, and many Afro descendants here also. So why not to understand that arrogance doesn't function anymore? We have to have good partnership and respect for each other here.
One of our local writers, Felicia Gustin, wrote an article which was entitled, "Cuba is more than rum and cigars and beaches." And it's quite an interesting article. The notion of developing bilateral relations rather than unilateral relations, Cuba and what it would bring to a change, this process toward normalization with the United States. Expound on some of those benefits, perceived benefits of a relationship with the United States that is changing.
Yes. For instance, since 1982, we are developing the biotech industry in Cuba. We have many achievements as the result of those investments in biotechnology in Cuba, not only investment in the technologies, but investing in the human resources that we have in order to research about many important diseases that are affecting the Cuban people, but they are very, very common in the States and in many other countries of the world. Let us talk about diabetics, for instance. We have a very good medicine. It is called Heberprot P, and it is in order to prevent the amputations in the case of diabetic patients when they have ulcers, am I right? Yeah. Ulcers in their diabetics process. It is very important. We are very accurate with that. The results are amazing. In many countries, including in our country, I was visiting Ecuador 2 months ago. I could see the patients, how satisfied they are when they see that they were about to be amputated, and then it didn't happen, and now they have their 2 legs. Because in our medical doctrine, It's very important for us to keep not only the health of the person, but also the mental health of the patient. If you have your two legs, you are a person able to do by yourself. Another very good experience in the biotech industry has to do with the lung cancer vaccine. We have achieved a very good one. And I have heard that we are in many talks and many hopeful talks in order to have that vaccine here in the United States. Another thing has to do with the different medical treatments that we have in Cuba for many diseases. Why not to allow the US people to go to Cuba in order to participate in those health programs? Another proposal, Walter, could be, why don't we cooperate about the new technologies, but talking about internet governance and how to really deal with internet in terms of not subversion and espionage, but talking about internet as the means where we can develop many areas in Cuba and in the United States. We also have very good communication in our intellectual and cultural sectors and groups. So why not to think about a closer relation between poets, between hip-hop players, between people of different, like-minded here and there? Why not? These are areas of huge interest. Another thing has to do with the prevention when oil prospection is happening, and what about to protect our sea in order not to be damaged by those economic activities. Another thing has to do with protecting the environment in Cuba and here in the United States. We are very, very demanding in terms of the protection of the Cuban environment. Another thing has to do with our labor code. We should understand each other in terms of protecting our workers' rights. And in Cuba, now that it is possible some US investors going to Cuba, it is interesting for us to tell them, what about our labor code? Because it is very progressive. We protect women, for instance, for the maternity leave for a year with 60% of her salary, and 6 weeks before having a birth. Yeah?
Yes.
It is also protected by law. In Cuba, women receive the same salary for the same job. In Cuba, I mean, these are some of the examples why it is necessary to have a good understanding and a good cooperation among our two countries.
I'm going to put a couple of questions here together, and I want to come back and raise some other topics flowing off of what you said. One of the questions says, the Cuban Revolution took place more than 50 years ago. More than two generations have grown up in a society since 1958. Does the current generation appreciate the changes since then? And the other one was, with increased access by U.S. tourists, what steps are being taken to add capacity, hotels, and to in some senses, keep Cuba, Cuba? I guess the question is Cuba ready for normalization, this process towards normalization, more tourists coming, playing a different role in a global economy?
Okay, well, thanks for the questions. First of all, we are ready. We decided to change. We decided to update our economic model. And that new momentum in the Cuban-US relations is positive. We consider that we will have access to resources that have been just forbidden for the Cuban economy. Of course, we know we have challenges, but we are decided to face them. We consider that new generations in Cuba, we witnessed the changes since 1959 until the present. Of course, at the beginning, Cuba was a very, very poor country. The gap between rich and poor was huge. Women was not even participating in politics. Today, we are 48.8% of the national parliament in Cuba, and 46% in the locally elected officials, I mean, members of the people's power system, is the way we call our democratic system. Another thing has to do with access to higher education, for instance. At the beginning of the revolution, we just had 3 universities in Cuba, one in Havana, one in Villa Clara, in the central of the island, and one in Santiago. Now we have universities in every province and in the majority of the municipalities of Cuba. Another aspect has to do, Walter, I think, I have many examples, but just to mention some of them, regarding the political participation of the people. Now when you go to Cuba, people is more demanding in terms of how to vote in the elections. Voting is not compulsory in Cuba, and people is going to vote, but now they are more demanding with our elected representatives. People is going there, but permanently they are saying, okay, but we need to see the results of the process of decision making. That's why we have decided to give more power to the local governments, to give more power for them to decide about the budget, to give more power to decide about how to combine the community efforts with the central efforts and the main government efforts in order to develop the poorest areas of the country. It is, for instance, in the eastern countries of Cuba. The occupation of Guantanamo, for instance, is not only a violation of our sovereignty, it is also a huge limitation for our economic development. That bay is very rich, the Guantanamo Bay that is illegally occupied. And it is another aspect that despite the occupation of the Guantanamo Bay, despite the blockade, we are trying to make huge efforts. Of course, when you talk to the Cuban citizens, I'm not going to say that they are 100% satisfied with everything. Of course not. We are a normal country. People has all kinds of lack of satisfaction with many things. For instance, we are very critical about the situation of the public transport in Cuba. We are very critical about housing plans in Cuba. Very critical about the salary and how salary is covering the main expenses of the families. Although we have free education, free healthcare, so the people in Cuba is not thinking about having a salary to pay school or a hospital. It's not the case of Cubans. But of course, we have other needs and you need better salaries. Now with the updating of the economic model of Cuba, 500,000 Cubans are now self-employed. And it is interesting to tell you because although we have decided that the state enterprise will be the main source of the Cuban development, those cooperatives and individuals, self-employed, are also part of the changes and the new opportunities that have been opened in our economy. So a combination of the two, I believe that is giving a different face to the Cuban economic dynamics, and I hope in the future we could say that if the relations are better between Cuba and the US, those things will be better. If we cannot achieve the lifting of the blockade, our strategy is not to stop trying to develop by ourselves and diversifying our external relations with many countries of the world.
There have been a couple of questions.
Did I answer the questions?
You did answer the question. You did answer the question.
There have been many
a couple questions,
of questions in here,
around the issue of the Cuban Five in terms of the role that they played in the normalization process. This was another part of the discussion. But I wanted to add on to that the issues that UNIAC and other organizations have been involved in around issues of LGBT communities as well as African diaspora communities, knowing that there's a large movement of Afro descendants throughout the Caribbean, South America, and issues of race and power are raised. How is Cuba addressing that, those issues of diverse communities? And what role did the Five play in this process?
Thank you. Well, the Five Cubans that were in prison in the United States during 16 years, they are free now, and I feel that their freedom is also the confirmation that they were defending Cuba. They were defending something that is really worthy to be defended. And the Five also are telling to many people in Cuba and in many countries of the world how do they felt about the U.S. people? How were they able to understand the reality of the United States? Although they were in prisons, but they had the opportunity to talk to many people there in the prisons. They had letters from 27,000 people from 67 countries of the world in these 16 years in prison. And they met with many Afro descendants here in the US prisons. They met people of different nationalities, even Cubans that are in prison. And their experience, when they go to many places, they are now telling about that. And of course, they are able to explain that they never felt any kind of revenge towards the people of the United States, because we understand that we are not any threat for the people of the United States, because they felt that many families here in the US, when the relatives of the five came to visit them, they received solidarity from many, many people in this country, no matter if they were similar to our ideas or not. They did that because of human feelings that they expressed to the five and to their relatives. Another important thing has to do with the announcement of the Cuban-US relations. The same day, on December 17th, the two announcements were made: the freedom of the three of the remaining of the five, and also the rejoining of the diplomatic relations. And we were celebrating that because it was a US citizen that was also in prison in Cuba. He could return to the United States. The three Cubans returned to Cuba. So it's a kind of common sense triumph. It is something that's very good to see that it is happening today between our two countries. And why not to be inspired in such decisions in order to think about the future without any kind of revenge? Another thing has to do with the five, and also the debate on LGBT and race in Cuba, right? And all these activities and debates. It is a very strong movement in Cuba for those, the different activists. In the case of LGBT community, we are organizing for more than probably 8 years now a week of actions against homophobia in Cuba. It has been very good. You know that we are a Latino country. You know that we are male chauvinists. And we have, yes, I'm clear. I'm very frank with you. It is not going to be, you know, like that. It is a process of educating the people, educating in the sense of respect for each other also. And it is something that, in my understanding, we are doing well. And in Parliament, we had very good talks and very good debates on that. We are in the process of approving a new family code in Cuba, where many topics are in debate, but including the LGBT community rights in Cuba. Another thing related to the debate on race in Cuba, the Cuban Revolution has been very inclusive. The Cuban Revolution has eliminated, since the institutional points of view, all kinds of discrimination. But of course, we have inherited hundreds of years of slavery, of racism, and in 57 years, when you see Cuba, and some of you have been visiting Cuba, you can see that we are relating to people of all kinds of persons, and the color of the skin is not a problem to establish social relations in Cuba. Not marriage, not any other kinds of relations. Our kids go to the same schools, so there is no segregation in the Cuban society. Of course, when the economic crisis started in the special period, we are conscious about the impact of the special period and the economic crisis in those race relations in Cuba. Not because of being Afro-descendant or being a white or Spanish descendant. No, it is because the starting point for the black population, it is of a process of more suffering in the history of Cuba than the one that have the poor white population of Cuba. That's true, and it is, I don't know if you understand me, I'm trying to explain something, but that is a process in our case. So we are conscious about that. We are not saying all kinds of racial discrimination is eliminated already in Cuba. What we are saying is that the conditions of Cuba are very good one in order to really abolish all kinds of discrimination in Cuba, including the discrimination because of their race. And also, you know that the terminology race is a fiction. It is an artificial construction. We are all human beings. And that's something that we learn when we are very young in Cuba. Yes, your skin is this one or that one, but we are all equals. And we have to guarantee access and opportunities for everyone in Cuba. And I believe we have very good conditions to do so in the present and in the future. But in Cuba, for you to have a leading role in parliament or in any institution, we are not looking to the color of the skin. If you are looking to be in business with anyone, we are not taking that into consideration. And I know it is a debate because in the States, for instance, as far as we know, it is the affirmative actions and these experiences. In our case, for instance, we are 48.8% in parliament, women. We haven't assigned quota laws for that. So it's a different experience in Cuba. And when you go to Cuba and you look to those aspects, one thing that I would like you to include in your analysis is not to look Cuba through the eyes of the US reality. Our reality is different. And just to compare Cuba with what it was in the 50s, in the 60s, and how we are today, and how committed we are to be in the future more and more inclusive society. It is my opinion on that, Walter.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Kenya Serrano, a member of the Cuban Parliament and the president of ECAP, the Cuban Institute for Friendship with the People. We're going to begin to take some of the audience questions, and we'll fold them together. There's quite a few here. One of the issues that's raised here, do you expect to continue the Cuban program of two currency, one of CUC's and the other of Cuban pesos? And let's tie that with this question on the issue of property ownership and whether foreign nationals be able to purchase property or how you see that working in Cuba.
Okay. The two currency circulation is going to be finished in few months, probably, because we are going for a reunification of the currency, just to leave one. Because, of course, it was a strategy to survive the crisis in the 90s, but we consider it is enough time to have that problem in our economy. We have to correct that because it is adding inefficiency in the economic and financial analysis of the Cuban economy. So we are in the process to eliminate that double currency circulation and we go for one currency, that it will be the Cuban peso. Remember that we are not allowed to use the US dollar as a currency. So that's another obstacle that has to do with the blockade. But that we cannot change it. It has to be the US Congress and the people here to change it. But in our side, it is to unify the one currency, and it will happen. Another thing has to do with the properties. Foreigners that are not permanent residents in Cuba cannot have properties in Cuba. So it is clear for us because, you know, we are a poor country and we preserve the main properties are in state hands. So it is what I can answer to that question. Of course, when you go to Cuba as an investor, our law is very clear about the rights that an investor has in order to establish and open offices in Cuba and so on, to build hotels or whatever. But the land continues belonging to the people of Cuba. We don't include the land in the properties that we are building and the facilities, let's say, that are being built in Cuba that, or that will be built in Cuba in the process of the foreign investment.
The next question we have on the table here is, what is your opinion, what in your opinion is the biggest obstacle to ending the blockade? And let's tag on to that a question, since you've been here, you came out last week on Tuesday, you've had a chance to see the press and answer questions. What are some of the biggest misrepresentations of Cuba that you see and hear in the media? So one was there about the biggest obstacles to ending the blockade, and from your time here, looking at your country through this lens, mm-hmm. the misrepresentation.
Well, the biggest obstacle has to do with the debate in Congress. There are various proposals, more than 40, Leyma? More than 40 proposals in Congress, in Senate, and in the law chamber, is that how you call it? Some of them are positive, but the one that is related to the travel ban, for instance, it just have 45 representatives that sponsored that proposal. So it is necessary to do more advocacy work here with the representatives in Congress in order to achieve better results regarding the change of the U.S. policy on Cuba. Another obstacle has to do with the financial persecution. It is horrendous. Our transactions are being persecuted everywhere. If you put the word Cuba in a transaction, that money will be lost. So it is really terrible for our economy. We are always looking in order to find a third place where to send our money to that country where we are buying some supplies and so on. And currently, after December the 17th, few companies and banks have been fined for accepting to preserve the Cuban accounts. For instance, Commerzbank from Germany, Paribas from France, thousands of millions of dollars as a fines. So this is a real obstacle. And of course, another obstacle is that regime change programs. They should be stopped, and of course, to invest that money in a goodwill cooperation and not trying to change our minds and trying to tell us what to do in Cuba, because we are empowered to decide by ourselves. And another question was?
That was it. I was asking about the issue of the
obstacle.
We'll keep going from this one here.
Obstacle of the blockade, I already answered.
Right, what was the biggest blockade obstacle to ending the blockade?
Yeah.
The next question we have here is on foreign assets and nationalization. Mm-hmm. Two questions.
Yeah.
Is there any discussion in Cuba of reimbursing nationalized assets? How can investors be convinced that asset nationalization will not be an issue in the future?
Which is the word they use, reimbursing?
It means reimbursing, meaning it's applying to those people who have claims on property or resources,
okay.
who have left Cuba and no longer in Cuba, or mm-hmm. their companies have been nationalized as in the early 1960s. Is there any discussion about being reimbursed, about being compensated for those assets?
Well, in fact, it is in the table. It is the U.S. government have said that it is the interest of the U.S. government to talk about that. Of course, the nationalizations that were made back in 1959, 1960, it was a need of the Cuban Revolution in order to establish the social property in Cuba, because the majority of the enterprises were in U.S. hands, companies. So it was a sovereign decision. It is recognized by international law. Immediately, the Cuban government at the time suggested and presented the way to pay back to those peoples affected by those nationalizations, but it was the government who didn't accept it, us to pay in a proper way. Many other governments accepted, from Europe, from Belgium, from many other, from France, they did accept it, but it was not the case of the United States. And also, there is one prohibition that Obama cannot change, and it is that those foreign investors coming from the U.S. going to Cuba cannot invest in properties that were nationalized to U.S. citizens. So it is another obstacle for the investments of the U.S. people in Cuba. It is in the table. It is a topic. It doesn't mean, in my view, as a member of the Cuban parliament, that we are going to forget about our sovereign decisions in the past. The internal aspects of Cuba are not in the table of debate with any other government. These are our internal decisions, our decisions that are part of our history, and what we are thinking today is in the future, in the next steps to go forward, but not revising the past decisions that we have made.
One of the things that it was interesting, one of the gentlemen, Jorge Risque, who many say other than Fidel Castro and Raul Castro and Che Guevara did more for the liberation of Africa, specifically in Angola, than any other person we could think about. This commitment of a country which is small and quote unquote poor to internationalism, explain that to us in terms of doctors and in Angola and Central America. Why is this part of the Cuban narrative, this commitment to internationalism?
Well, Cuba is the result of a melting pot of many nationalities of the world. We are very proud of our African origin. We also have Spanish background. We have Chinese, Arabs. We have people coming from all over the world. Slaves were brought to Cuba when the slavery, and of course, all this background is very clear in our nation and the way we feel Cuba. And that's why we always said that it is to pay our debt with humanity. And we have been able to send people, about 500,000 Cubans already have been in cooperation in internationalist missions, that's how we call them, to more than 60 countries of the world already, including to fight apartheid in Africa. And also, currently, we are doing many other programs. Let us mention the Yes, I Can program, and it is for literacy campaigns in about 30 countries of the world, including last June, I had an excellent opportunity to meet with the indigenous people in Australia. And in some indigenous communities in Australia, we have had a very good experience, very successful, applying that program. The two Cuban teachers went there, prepared the leaders, the indigenous leaders for the program, and they are able to teach their people in the communities how to read and write. And it is thanks to the experience we had before in the English-speaking Caribbean islands. So it is very interesting, another kind of cooperation. In the past, because of the need of the African countries, we sent soldiers. In the present, because of the need of many countries, we send doctors, we send teachers. And I have to tell you, we are proud of that. We are not feeling any kind of arrepentimiento, regret for that. We feel that it is necessary when you see people that is learning how to read and write, when you see people that never ever in their lives, imagine in the Pacific Islands, have you looked to the map? The Pacific Islands that will disappear because of the climate change. In East Timor, we have more than 800 graduates from the Cuban medical school. And nowadays, currently, the healthcare system in East Timor, it's been reorganized, and the family medicine program is being organized thanks to those doctors graduated in Cuba. So these kind of things are very valuable, and for us, Walter, it is a principle. It doesn't have to do with the propaganda about the Cuban reality. In fact, Fidel, he is always saying, in terms of solidarity, we have to do more and talk less. So he's very, with that, yes, that's Fidel. He's amazing, and he always said, not to talk a lot about this, just do that. And it has happened to Cuba. When we send vaccines to many countries where they don't have a coin to buy any medicine, and Cuba just prepare a plane and send the vaccines without talking to the press, but the people receive. When it was the earthquake in Pakistan, we sent the brigade. When Katrina, we were ready to send a brigade here, Henry Reeve Brigade. It was not accepted by the US administration, but believe me, we were ready. It was not a media operation. We were ready, our doctors. And then as it was not possible, the situation happened in Pakistan and they went there. So it is quite interesting to see that, yes, it is possible to have this kind of cooperation programs. And it is part of understanding the world and being more open-minded in terms of world's situation and how to preserve the achievements that we have in Cuba.
Thank you. Three questions. I work at Walmart. We are fighting for better conditions and a union. Are there unions in Cuba? That's question number one. Question number two.
Are there unions in Cuba?
Unions, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Question number two. When will there be full freedom of the press and the unjamming of electronic radio and TV stations from the United States? And question number three. I have been active in the struggles against violence by police towards workers and youth. What is the relationship of police to the communities in Cuba, especially those of color? So the first question was about union.
Yeah.
The second question was about freedom of the press, unjamming of singles. And the third was about police relationships in Cuba.
Yes, thank you. Well, the trade unions are very strong in Cuba. We have the Central Trade Union, but we have 17 different big trade unions in Cuba. They belong to many international bodies. They represent the Cuban workers in many international organizations. And about 92 or 95% of the Cuban workers are unionized. And when we talk about the self-employed workers, more than 80% of them are already members of the unions because they are also protected. Even those that do not belong to the unions, they are also protected by law, but if they belong to the union, they have more resources in order to defend their rights. And of course, it is in Cuba, in our understanding, we have the freedom of press.
Yes.
and participation in people's opinion is quite open. Of course, remember that Cuba has been facing a very high hostility coming from the different administrations in the US. And it has been a key aspect in order to establish some of the limits of the freedom of speech in Cuba. I'm very frank with you. When you see that you are under, for instance, a state terrorism against Cuba, 5,077 Cubans have been victims of the US state terrorism, including a civil airplane that was blown up back in 1973 with 73 passengers. It is part of the history of Cuba. Many of the Cuban buildings and people, diplomats, have been killed because of the terrorist actions. So all these things has to do with our recent past. And in Cuba, that's true that you are allowed, you have the right to dissent, you have the right to present your different viewpoint on things, but that's true also that because of the regime change programs, we have people that are paid in order to say, to express opposition to the Cuban government. So if you are paid for saying something, if you are paid for adopting a different position or an opposition to a government, you are a mercenary. You are not a dissident. It is our analysis on that. Because when you are expressing yourself freely and so on, that's okay. The revolution is part of the permanent evolution and a debate and the right you have to think by yourself. But if you are receiving money to print a newspaper or to express yourself, for us it is clear that it is not part of that understanding of the freedom of speech. The other question?
And the last question was on a writer who said they've been very active in the struggles against violence by police towards workers and youth. What is the relationship of police to the communities in Cuba, especially those communities of color?
First of all, the police in Cuba has a very strong ethical code. The police has to behave properly. If a citizen is violating the law, that police has to act, but respecting that person, respecting that human being. It is very strange in Cuba to see a police using the weapons, the guns. It's very, very rare to see that in Cuba. And the main role of the police in Cuba is a preventive role, is to be in places where it is necessary their presence, but is very respectful. And I think that this feeling of civil understanding that we have in Cuba, the education that we give to our population, is one of the aspects that guarantee that people is confident that the police will act when someone is affected, and people do not have to take justice by his or her hands. The institutions, the jury, the attorney is functioning. You don't have to go and to do that by yourself. It is a system that functions and represents the people. So it is important for us to underline that. And of course, in Cuba, in my understanding, I understand the question, but we don't have community segregated. I said that before, but Cubans live like we live. In a building, you find people of all kinds of sectors and all kinds of origins and so on. So the police acts in the same way everywhere in Cuba. It is not something that we can say. I'm very frank, of course. Our police has many things to learn, many things to understand in order to guarantee in a better way all human rights. But of course, in my view, it is safe, it is respectful, it has a professional behavior, and is very respectful regarding people and, of course, protecting the law of Cuba.
There's three questions. I'll try to wrap them together. The risk of economic privatization. The other one is talking about that American corporate elites will be flooding Cuba. Is there disagreement within the Cuban government about how much to constrain and regulate the American invasion? And the last one was the American invasion. After I'm reading the
Bay of Pigs. Bay of Pigs.
And the other one heard your someone else heard your presentation. They're saying, what is Cuba doing to promote pluralism, democracy, eliminate censorship, and protect human rights? On that question about the privatization, certainly over the last few years, Cuba has opened a window of non-state employment.
Yes.
And so there's been some changes from the six-party Congress. So talk a bit about that issue of the risk. Is there disagreement within Cuba? Is there fear within Cuba? And the issue of democracy and eliminating censorship.
Well, we don't call it exactly a privatization. It is different ways to manage the property, because the main properties in Cuba remains in state's hands. Of course, we respect private property to everyone. In Cuba, more than 80% of Cubans own their houses, own our houses, because I'm one of them. So it is that we have prepared the process for the people to become the owner of the house, apartment or a house, whatever, but it is possible to own your house in a process you pay, but it is the day, it's not very long that you can own your house. It is respected. The land for the people that they have it, it is respected and so on. So the process in Cuba to allow thousands of Cubans to make the land produce, it is a very good decision. It's a very good decision because we are promoting people to produce food. We want to achieve food security in Cuba. So it is a kind of things that I believe should be better understood. Regarding how the media portrayed Cuba, I think one of the things is Cuba is going to capitalism. Well, I can tell you, we are not going to capitalism. We are reinforcing, strengthening our socialist character, but in a Cuban style. And for sure, there is a combination of measures that belong to the transit from capitalism to socialism, because this world is globalized in a capitalist way. So It is clear for us that we cannot say we are socialists 100%. It is not. It is a process, and property is there. It is, but the main property that will remain in the Cuban model is the social property. It is the real guarantee that the main industries and the main productions in Cuba are in state hands, because the state has a regulatory role to play. We believe that neoliberalism is just a failure. We believe that those theses where the state has nothing to do in a country are a failure, and we defend the state that is really strong and regulates all the economies. But also we defend that the state has not do no, the state do not have to control everything in the economy. That's something we are very clear about, and that we listen, and it is one of the guidelines of the current process of updating the Cuban economy. We take into consideration the market, but the main sectors of the Cuban economy is plan. I mean, it is an economic planning for guaranteeing the Cuba's development, and it is the combination that we are having today. Another thing has to do with the freedom of
press and so on.
Yes. Again, I tell you, in Cuba, we have interesting experiences on that. It is a huge and controversial debate about the role of the media in Cuba today. It is in the many Congress for the National Union of Journalists. It is present in the Congress and debates and assemblies and committees and informal groups that belongs to the National Union of Artists and Writers of Cuba. They are all involved in that process, and it is healthy for the Cuban Revolution. Because in the past, it was a situation where hostility was there and so on. If these situations are changing, we are also ready to understand those changes and to reshape the way we do the freedom of expression and the freedom of press in Cuba. Why not? But so far, I can tell you that it is a very interesting debate on that and the role of the media in Cuba. How much do the media criticize the mistakes of the Cuban Revolution? That's something that is very clear for us, because José Martí said that to criticize is something that is healthy for any process, for the government, for whatever. And it is important for you to know that we are clear about that. And we are more connected today with many other experiences, progressive experiences in the world, in Latin America. We are in the process to have our own law for regulating all kinds of media and communication resources. So it is a very good process, and I hope in the future we can tell you new achievements on those areas too.
In our last minute, I get the last question. What can we, I reflect sometimes that when I leave here and go to Southern Africa, you can get to Southern Africa faster from the West Coast than you can get to Cuba. What can we do to move forward as people, as a room of people who are committed to human rights and change and better relations? A couple of suggestions for us here in 1 minute.
First of all, to leave the blockade, because you are not allowed to have this kind of business with Cuba. Another thing has to do that some people and some decisions are in the way to be adopted to allow direct flights, regular flights from the U.S. to Cuba. But we are saying, what about the Cuban planes coming to the U.S.? And they say, no yet. So why not? It should be bilateral. It is not one-way situation. It should be a two-way understanding, a real partnership. And Walter, I believe that you could go to Cuba very often, you all. And please, to invite you to join Cuba, to join a visit to Cuba in ethical travels. It means respecting the Cuban sovereignty. Please do that. Think about that. It is very important for us. And those that have been able to visit Cuba have witnessed how open we are. We respect you. We understand who you are, and we try to learn from each other. There should not be an hegemonic knowledge. We should learn from each other. That's my advice on that.
Our thanks to Kenya Serrano, member of Cuban Parliament, president of ECAP, the Cuban Institute of Friendship with the People, and thanks to our audience here and those listening on the radio. I'm Walter Turner, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Thank you.